Okay, hello. So, as far as I can see, it's now 16 past the hour, so I think we'll get started. Hey, that's right. Okay, my name is Karen, and I'm going to be your guest lecturer today. Hey. And what we'll spend our time today, we'll talk about the next essay that you're going to hand in October. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk a little bit about how to research your paper, which you'll obviously be using for this essay, but as well as the coming essays this semester and the next. And we're going to talk about academic honesty because, well, it's a real issue in higher education, so we need to address it. That's the plan for today. There will be a recording of this lecture, but I also made some videos that you can use for repetition, and you'll find them at Vimeo. I'll give you the links later. That's the plan. Everyone can hear me well, yeah. I think the mic is a little too loud today, but I'll do my very best, okay? Yeah. Can you see the slides? Should we turn down the lights or it's all right? Yeah? Okay. Now, there aren't too many of us, so if you have any questions along the way, please don't hesitate to ask, and I'll do my very best to answer, of course. Yeah. Okay, so this is what the agenda looks like. We'll start with an introduction where I'll give you some information about your upcoming paper. And then I'll spend some time talking about researching your paper. We'll go through one or two databases and have a look at what you can find there. We'll spend some time talking about critical evaluation as an effort to sort of get you to use better sources. Hey. Part two, we'll talk about plagiarism, cheating, academic honesty. Things, you know, concerning these things and copyrighted materials. So probably part one will last at least for the first hour or maybe sometime into the second lecture, and then we'll spend the second half of the second lecture to talk about plagiarism, etc. Yeah. Okay. You're going to write a short paper, sometimes also referred to as essay number two. Your main subject is academic honesty. So you can choose between one of the three subtopics. So only one of the three subtopics. And the title of your essay should be the name for one of the three subtopics. So if you choose to write about open access, challenges and possibilities, that should be the title of your paper. And that just, you know, it makes it easier for the for the teachers to see what subtopic it chose. But you should also be aware that the subtopic that you choose should always be, you know, reflect the main topic, which is academic honesty. So if you want to write about open access, then you see open access in the light of academic honesty. You get it? Yeah? At least in theory. So the first one is open access, challenges and possibilities. Do you know what open access is? I mean, in the research world, obviously. Yeah, open access isn't necessarily the same as open data. if that's what you're thinking. Or open software. It's the same principle, sort of, but it's not what we really talk about here. Open access is a movement, a grassroots movement, that started quite a few years back, perhaps like 20 years ago. Hi. where, you know, researchers, they found out that this, or they probably already knew, but they made an effort to enlighten the rest of us on how incredibly unfair our publication system is. Because first, this institution will pay its researchers a salary to do research, then in some cases will pay to have it published, or we can pay to have our researchers do peer review for other researchers. They'll do that for free, you know, because it's included in their salary, sort of. And then we pay to have access to the journals that they publish in. So you see, we pay at least twice, or maybe even three times, for the same article. And some people will starting to think that this is incredibly unfair. And particularly for you know, schools or institutions in other parts of the world where the economy isn't really booming, so where they can't afford to buy it back. So actually they're paying for nothing because they can't access the research that their own researchers did. So then they started this sort of grassroots movement of open access. And there are some great opportunities, but also some challenges when it comes to academic honesty. So if you choose that subtopic, that's what we want you to explore. Subtopic number two is called the five pillars of ethical research. And those five pillars are honesty, trust, justice, respect, and responsibility. And in a paper of this subtopic, we would expect you to see or to explain something about each pillar. Yeah. And how that relates to academic honesty. Number three is called Plagiarism and Cheating, Two Rotten Eggs in the Research Egg Basket. And, well, we're going to talk about plagiarism and cheating later on. And you already know what it is, but we'll look into that. And you can explore that according to academic honesty. And preferably, you know, in the sense that you are in higher education. So how it relates to your situation would be good. Yeah. Everyone with me on the topics? Yeah? Okay. So now to the format. The maximum length of this paper, 2 pages. No more. And that is because there are 100 of you and probably 2 teachers that get to do this work. I usually do it, but I can't this year. So some teachers within the faculty will do it. They will probably give you some comments, and they will either pass you or fail you. Pass or fail. Nothing in between. Yeah. And you need to pass this essay before your exam. Yeah. Okay. So make an effort, you know, for your own sake and for the teacher's sake. You get 2 shots of getting this right. Yeah. So if you fail the first time, please do read the comments. And then, you know, fix your paper according to the comments. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I've seen through the last few years, I've had a similar essay given to this course the last few years, and what I'm seeing is that, you know, I make an effort, I read through, I mark everything, I give you comments, and then second draft, still the same things. So you really do need to read the comments and try to fix it, fix the problems. Because this is what this essay is about. It's training you to write better. If you don't understand the comments, it's perfectly all right to ask a teacher to explain. You know. So if you don't understand, just please just ask them. Yeah. One of the things also very important in this essay is that you use scholarly sources and that you cite them correctly, both in text, and make the bibliography right according to the chosen style. We'll talk about that later. But one of the things about this is it's a very short paper, so I'm sure you'll be able to do this right. But it's one of the things is that we see is that students are struggling with this. They're struggling with finding the right sources to use, and some of them are struggling really, you know, to make it right with the in-text and the bibliography citations. And you need to get it right, because this is one of the things that will just get worse as we go along. And if you fail on this, doing this in your master thesis eventually, that will be a huge deal. And this is just a 2-page paper. So take this opportunity and practice. Okay? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, I know. I haven't really corrected that previously. So, but it should be, you know, the text should be legible. So you can't really use like 4 points to squeeze more words in. But, you know, it should be legible at least. But, you know, if you use 10 point or 12 point, I don't really care. So, and of course, it looks a little different. Those of you who use Word and those who use LaTeX, it will look a little different. But try to get everything into 2 pages. Yeah. So no word count now. But I think 2 pages are usually about 1,000 words, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. But that's including the bibliography. We don't usually count the words in the bibliography, but, you know, just to give you an idea. Yeah. Any more questions about this? We've given you a fair deadline this time. They usually just get 1 week. But now you have a little over 2 weeks to get it done. So good chances. You only have to write 1 page this week and get it done in plenty of time. Please do note the deadline, because in the videos that I made, I said, I gave you 1 week. So I said October 13th, but it really is 21st, so I'm underlining that. The due date is the October 21st, not the 13th. Okay? Yeah. Okay. If you have any more questions about this, you can ask, okay? When you, yeah, remember what you want to ask about. Yeah. You can also ask your teachers, of course. Please do upload in PDF. Because, yeah, it makes it a lot easier for all of us, yeah. Okay. So, moving on. Giving you a little time to recall what we're doing here. I'm sure that you have, you know, no doubt you have done this before, but maybe not as structured as we really do expect you to do. Maybe not in this paper, but, you know, coming work, you will have to do a more structured literature review for some of your papers. And of course, needless to say, this process is not linear. So you go back and forth between the different stages. Now, you find a topic, you do your searches, you evaluate, you go back to searching, you do more evaluation, we do some reading, we go back to searching, you know, back and forth. Yeah, this is how we do it. Some things, though, I want to say is that when you're reading, you should really look for the essence of your papers, because, or books, or whatever your source is. Sometimes I walk around the library for some reason, you know, going to get something, or, yeah. And then I see students with their yellow markers, and they're just, you know, marking everything they read. And then I'm thinking, you know, there's no way that 100% of an article is just as exciting and important as the rest. So try to look for the real gold, you know, in what you're reading. What is the essence? And then you synthesize this and you explain how it relates to your topic. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for new information. And you should always have that, you know, with you when you're reading. Yeah? So I'm sure this is fairly, you know, that you've done this before. But I want to make one suggestion, just a tip. Cite as you go. You know, don't leave that to the end of the paper, because suddenly it isn't where you thought it was, you've got the page numbers right or wrong, and you can't remember where you found it, and then you have a real problem. And, you know, yeah, I could give you some examples, but I think I'm not going to do that. But it takes a while, you know, it takes a while to find what you want to use and to read it, to understand it, to synthesize it, put it into your paper. It takes a while. So it's a good idea to get started quickly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, searching for information. How many of you use Google first? Yeah, I think the rest of you are probably lying. I do that too, you know? I use Google, or, you know, equivalents, for almost everything. But there are some issues connected with it. I'm not saying it's not a good idea, because it is. It is a good idea, but not for all purposes. For personal information, it's great. For academic purposes, it's sometimes good and sometimes not. So it's great to use... well, I use Google Scholar. I'm sure you do too. But it's a good idea to get the big picture using Google Scholar or... you know, Aurea, which is the library catalogue, to get a big picture, sort of the idea of what's going on in the field. But once you need to be more structured, then you really need to move into some of the databases, because Google Scholar will not give you, they will not give out any information about what they're looking for, what they send their crawlers to, what kind of documents, what they're looking for, what they're not looking for. And, of course, they give you, like, 15,000 retrieved documents without, well, giving you information about what they left out. So it's a great place to start, but it's not really structured enough to suit all of your needs. Maybe you could get by for this paper. But probably not for the next one and the next one after that. So sooner or later, you need to move into some of the databases, and you can just get started right away. So Aurea and Google Scholar, good for getting the big picture, and you can use Google Scholar for citation purposes, you know, figure out who wrote about this article that you found, etc. Have you done that before? using Google Scholar for citation. Yeah, some have not. But I thought I'll just, you know, go into one or two of the databases and show you a couple of things. You can also use the... obviously, we can use some of the videos that are available on our YouTube channel. There are tutorials and everything there. But you can also use the help page if you need some help. But, you know, obviously, you are very tech-savvy and everything, so I'm sure you can handle it. And pretty much every student can handle searching in the databases. It's not the databases itself that are the problems. The problem is figuring out what you're going to search for, right? So the words are the problems and not the technical solutions. But you can either go into... I'll switch this to English. You can either go into the library page and do the searches from there. That was very slow. Okay, I give up. Or you can go to aurea.no. This is the library catalog. It also has an English button right here. Okay. So searching here will give you books, journal articles, titles of journals, proceedings, patents, well, pretty much anything. You can just, you know, do a quick search and see what you get access to. Or you can use the databases up here, and it will give you an alphabetical list. If I do Springalink, it's right down here. Now, Springalink is a very good database for you to use. I'm not, you know, totally crazy about the graphical interface here, but it has very good content. It also has the lecture notes on computer science that you'll probably get closer acquainted to later on. You can have a search up here, and if I do want to have something with academic honesty, and I want to have higher education, and, well, what we do, plagiarism. I use quotation marks to search for strings, but you know, already know this, right? Yeah, same with Google. Yeah. So 95 results for that search string. Can you see up here, it says include peer review or review only content. That's a very good idea. Just leave that box checked, because it will only then retrieve articles from peer-reviewed journals. Do you know what peer review is? Yeah, some do. Yeah, I'll just take you quickly through that later on. You can refine by content, or discipline, subdiscipline, and language. Language seems a little weird because most of it is in English, but it is a German publisher, Springer, so you might get some things in German as well. I don't know how your German is, but you know, mine is only suited for buying food and asking for directions, so I can't really read academic German anymore. So refining by language can be a good idea. 95 results, that's not too bad. In essay number 2, you really are allowed to use any kind of scholarly source. And I'm saying scholarly, I mean academic, but not obviously popular science or anything of that kind. So it needs to, you know, be scholarly. Probably all 95 here are scholarly of some sort, because it says review only. Let's see. I now refine by article because I think maybe it takes away all the kind of reference work entries, like encyclopedic knowledge, and you're not really looking for that in this case. You're looking for arguments or information or data, some research done on plagiarism in higher education. So, do you see anything that you might be able to use? Yeah? Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. If I was writing the one on plagiarism and cheating, the two rotten eggs, I think number one there might be, you know, within the scope, don't you? It says something about contract cheating. Do you know what that is? It's when you pay someone to have your papers written for you. Yeah. And that's what it says, a new challenge for academic honesty, because obviously when you pay someone to write an original work, it is still an original work. You didn't do it. But it's hard to use like plagiarism tools to discover it. So I think that could be a good idea. Yeah. Usually when I search for things, I use a checklist. Now I've done it so many times that sort of the checklist has become something that I do automatically. But you may have to do it a few times to sort of get internalized that sort of checklist. And we're going to use that checklist now when we're looking for things. This is about critical evaluation or what you're going to use, right? So if I go back to my PowerPoint, I'll just take you quickly through the checklist, and then we'll use that checklist to go through the retrieved list. So this is the kind of checklist that I use. So I've sort of ask questions about the source that I want to use. Are you used to using that kind of checklist? Yes, some people are, some people are not. The first thing I look for, obviously, is the title. Does the title match my needs? Yes or no? So if it's no, then of course we toss it out the window and then move quickly on to the next. If it's yes, then I ask, what kind of a document is this? Is it a journal article? Is it a proceeding? Is it a book? Is it a reference work? What is it? And the reason why I'm asking this question is because obviously if I'm looking for a journal article, then a book won't cut it. And if I'm looking for encyclopedic knowledge, then an article is not what I'm looking for. So then I can quickly move on to the next. If it's not, out with it, next. Yeah? If it is what I'm looking for, then I look for peer review. Now, just quickly to say what peer review is, when I'm writing academic papers, I do sometimes, and I want to have them published in an academic source, or a scholarly source, I should say. I send it in to an editor, and the editor finds a suitable jury, peer reviewers, yeah. And they would be someone who has an interest in my field of expertise, and they usually have some sort of education that resembles mine, but they're usually more experienced. Yeah, so they could be my teachers, sort of. And then they go through my articles. I don't know who they are, and they don't know who I am. So they're reading through everything, marking everything I got wrong, where I need better sources for my argument, to support my argument. They look for everything from like spelling mistakes to data mistakes, you know, everything. They really look very closely. And then usually they will send it back via the editor to me. And then I'll get a list of things I need to fix before I can have it published. And sometimes that list can be really long. And then, you know, I have to decide whether or not I want to spend any more time doing it, or if I want to just leave it and not have it published. I can also, you know, get the feedback that they don't want it in their journal, that, you know, the subject is not relevant for them or something. Or they can say that it's perfect, we'll take it as it is. But that almost never happens. It usually comes back with some sort of note. And no one is saying that peer review is perfect, because it isn't. Because even the peer reviewers are people. So they are looking at my work. I've tried to be objective, right? I've tried not to say things like I think or I, because it's not about me. It's about the issue. So I've tried to be objective and to use sources to support my argument. And then they are people who are looking for mistakes. Yeah, but they're still people. So no one is saying that this is a perfect system, but it is the best form of quality assurance that we have so far. Maybe someday we'll figure out a better system, but yeah, we want the things that you are going to use as sources to be peer-reviewed. In our eyes, that means it's scholarly. Yeah. Any questions so far? Do you like having kind of a checklist? Yeah? It makes things a little easier, doesn't it? Yeah. So, the next thing I'm looking for is, what year or what date is it published? Is it too old? Yeah? Are you really no one's going to ask the question? How old is too old? I always get that question. And the unpopular but correct answer to that is, it depends on what you're writing about, what your subject is. You know, if you're writing about something, some new development in interaction design, then maybe, you know, 2 years ago is too long. And it takes a while to get things published. So if it was published in 2016... the data was probably from 2015 or older, because it takes a while. Peer review takes a while. And then getting all the corrections right, and then this should be, you know, released and published electronically. It takes a year, you know, to get anything published, really. Yeah. So just bear that in mind. Then I look for the IMRAD structure. Is that known to you? No. IMRAD stands for Introduction, Method, Results and Discussion. And that is sort of the internationally approved, in lack of a better word, standard for how things should be structured. So when I'm thinking that this article is pretty good, I think I'm going to use this, then I look for the IMRAD structure, because it sort of secures that all the pieces are with them, that you have a methods chapter, that you have a bibliography, that you have, you know, because it follows the international structure for it. Going to have a look at this later. Then I look for the methods chapter. Do they describe how they've gotten the data that they have, if it's an empirical study? If it's a literature review, the methods chapter should describe how they have searched for information, what has been included and what has not been included. Almost as important. Yeah. And then I look for the bibliography. some researchers, or some writers, I should probably say, are very into citing their earlier work. Well, that has several, you know, upsides to them. First of all, it gets their citations up. So very important in academia. And then it's easier because they already know what they've already written. So it's things that they, you know already. And, well, there are several benefits to this. And sometimes it's completely natural because when you've sort of selected something that you're an expert in, it's only natural that you cite your only work to some degree. But if you're sort of looking at the author and then looking at the bibliography and you can see author, 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 and you know all the previous things, then you should really start thinking, okay, so an article that this author wrote 10 years ago is still relevant. That's interesting, you know? And sometimes it's just one or two journals that every source is from. And some editors are even, you know, pretty sly, and they say, can't you find some information, some source from my journal that you want to cite? Because then the citation of the journal goes up. Really dirty business, this. So I always check the bibliography, not just for length, but for complexity. Does this sound a little more elaborate than this the strategies that you use? Yeah, I know. But, you know, after you've done it for a while, it will sort of get internalized. So you can have a look and just sort of use your eyes and just see whether or not it's a good thing. Yeah. It takes a little while, though, so you should get practicing, but yeah. Okay, I have a little more time, so I think I'm just going to go back now to the retrieved documents list that I got in Springlink, and then we can use this checklist. Okay, here we are. Can you see okay up there? Yeah. So, number one, how is it looking now? The title, it's relevant to the paper I want to write? Yes or no? Yes, right, we already agreed. Yes? So the next one, what kind of a document is it? And I've already said that I only want them to show me journal articles, so I know that it's journal article, so it's still in the yes pile, right? Number three, is it peer-reviewed? And now, really hit on the issue, how do we see that something is peer-reviewed? Yeah, you can't really, because it isn't printed on. If I ever become a world dictator, that'll be first on my list, that everything needs to be stamped with peer-reviewed. But seeing as that's not very plausible, we'll have to do with other issues. So I think I'm going to open it and have a look. You can read the article just as it is, or you can download a PDF if you like. Sometimes it's easier to see in the PDF version, so it might be a good idea if you're struggling. So how do we see if this is peer-reviewed? Yeah, you can't see it on the page. So we have to dig a little deeper. Now, this was published in the Journal of Academic Ethics. So what we need to figure out is the Journal of Academic Ethics a peer-reviewed journal? And that is easier to see. So we'll go that way. If we now... well, there are several ways to do this. For the Norwegian speakers, you can use a page called Publiseringskanalen. And you just Google Vitenskapelig Nivå and take the first one, but I don't think it has an English site, so we'll just do the alternative version, which is Googling the name of the journal. Journal of Academic Ethics. And if I open this up, I can see that there's a description field. And it says, the Journal of Academic Ethics is an interdisciplinary, peer-reviewed journal devoted to, etc. So yeah, they say that it is a peer-reviewed journal. So that's a good sign. However, it doesn't say that they peer review every item in the journal, does it? It doesn't say we peer review all our articles. So it just says it's a peer review journal. So it's a good sign, but we're not, you know, close but no cigar, as they say. Yeah. So what we have to do then is sort of go into the article itself and then use the other points of the checklist, and then it will be sort of implied whether or not it is good enough, the standard. Yeah. So let's see. I think I lost my place here, so I just have to do it again. Sorry. What did I search for? Academic honesty. Okay, so here we go. Yep. Okay, so the next point. What year is it? It's from 2012, isn't it? Would you say that was, you know, all right? 2012, that will be 4 years. Contract cheating. Has it developed much the last 4 years, do you think? Nah. I think it's probably, you know, within the scope, the limits of the scope, yeah. Yeah, I think that's okay. So the next thing is, does it have an IMRAD structure? I'm spending some time on this now because I want you to sort of see how we work with this checklist. Is it okay? Yeah. We'll have a break in just a few minutes. So there's an abstract. There are some keywords. And then it looks like there's an introduction. I for IMRAD, right? But it doesn't say that it is an introduction. Sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, it's okay. And they describe the aim of the paper, which is a good idea. You know, you want them to explain what they want with their paper. And that makes it easier for you to see whether or not that aim is aligned with your aims. Yeah. And now, this is quite interesting, actually, because it says that the aim of the paper is to provide an overview of available literature. So they don't really have their own... It's not an empirical study, it's a literature review. And what that means is that they don't have their own data. They're just looking for... to collect and give sort of... well, an overview, as they say, of the available literature on this. And I'm not saying that a literature review is less worth than an empirical study. It's just different. Their aims are different. So you need to know this when you're looking for information in it. So there's a definition and an overview. And since the scope of the study or the aim of the study is to provide an overview, I would say that this probably is the results chapter, the R in IMRAD. But did it have a methods chapter? No, I can't really see that. I was looking for some sort of explanation on what they've included and how they've searched for information. Can you see it? I can't really see it. Can you? No? So it looks like they don't have a methods chapter. Hello. So that's, you know, that's disappointing. We may have to review later whether or not we're going to include it. They do have a results chapter. Now, what I'm looking for, this is still results, I'd say, but problems of contract cheating may also be the discussion. So maybe that is the D in IMRAD. I will probably have to read the whole thing to see whether or not it is, but they use words like nonetheless, which seems to indicate that there is a discussion involved. So maybe that is the D. But then they have a detection, which sort of looks like results again. So I think it's safe to say that this doesn't follow the IMRAD structure. Yeah. Prevention, deterrence, this is still, you know, and then recommendations they do have. So sometimes that follows the discussion, but in this case, I wouldn't be too sure. And then I have a look at the bibliography called references here. Clark and Lancaster, you know, it's not working too good right now. What I want to see now, if Lancaster also has, yeah, you see, Lancaster and Clark. Then Lancaster is the first author. But they're still the same duo. Yeah. And maybe there's a perfectly natural explanation for this. But I'm thinking, you know, the warning lights are beginning to blink here. McCabe. I'm thinking this probably is not something that I want to use now. Do you agree? You're allowed to say no. You're allowed to say, this is still good, I'm using it. But I think I would at least question the quality of this. So actually, I was quite fortunate using the one first example there, because I could say something about it. And then I do this for something similar like this for the rest of the results. But of course, once you get some training, that will go faster. You won't spend as much time as I've just done on each one. And sometimes the title, you know, at the first point of your checklist, you will be able to just toss it aside because it isn't relevant. But of course, the better searches you do, the relevance will go up, of course. I think we need a break. And then if you will be back in 15 minutes, it's now 4 minutes past, so, you know, 20 minutes past, will that do? Get some coffee, and we'll move on. Okay. We're ready to continue. Well, moving into part two of this lecture, we are going to talk about plagiarism, cheating, and academic honesty. There's a reason for this being emphasized to such a degree in higher education these days. And the reason is that, unfortunately, more and more students are caught cheating and plagiarizing. And it is quite sad, actually, because, well, as we already know, the only one ended up cheating is yourself, of course. And also it can have some pretty serious repercussions for yourself. You know, people who are caught cheating are usually, you know, automatically failed at their exams and have to wait a year to do it again, and it has an economic side, and, you know, there are lots of really bad things that happen regarding this. But some are actually saying that the reason why cheating and plagiarizing is so widely done now are actually that the students have more power than they used to have. You can evaluate courses, you can tame your professors, and things like this. Whether or not it's true is a different matter, of course, but it is quite sad that it happens so frequently. And while I tend to believe that, at least when it comes to plagiarism, it is often, it happens by accident as much as everything else, I think. I do believe that. Perhaps because it's more convenient for me to believe that it is an accident, but also because I watch it happen. And I want to talk a little bit about this now, because you're heading into your master's program, and I don't want you to fail, at least not on these reasons. There's a difference between cheating and plagiarism. You can see that cheating is a wider term. And cheating is always intentional. Plagiarism is a form of cheating, but it isn't always intentional. So you can see that all plagiarism is cheating, but not all cheating is plagiarism. Yeah. Cheating involves, you know, paying someone to write your exams or papers. It can be forging data, using cheat sheets. It can be, well, all kinds of things. Plagiarism is always about representing other people's ideas as your own. So it's sort of a simpler concept that way. But I think what not all teachers talk about is self-plagiarism. Have you ever heard that term? No? Self-plagiarism is when you use previously approved papers, something that you've used previously, and then sort of cut-paste that into a new paper. And while not as frowned upon as pure plagiarism, it's still a problem. Because, well, I understand why it's done. Because, you know, sometimes when you do preliminary work in a subject field and you know you're going to write about it later, it's kind of natural in a way to use what you already wrote and just cut paste it into a new paper. But the problem is then that it doesn't fulfill the requirements that each paper has, and namely honesty and originality. Because every paper that you write here will have an element, or should have an element, of originality. And when you self-plagiarize, that doesn't fulfill that requirement. But I think it is too little talked about. And I just wanted to mention it to you, that self-plagiarism is also not done. It's not acceptable. There are many reasons why people act dishonestly in academia. But I find that a lot of the time it is lack of planning and lack of time. So, well, I can remember my own, vaguely, remember my own education, and you're pressured for time because you take several courses at the same time, and sometimes deadlines are following really quickly and quick succession. And, you know, I have a paper due tomorrow, and I also have a paper due on Monday. I have to finish this quickly so I can get, but that can lead you astray and make you go for the quick option instead of the best option. So I think good planning is very important. Easy to say, of course, but, you know, we've all been there, so yeah. But I think good planning really makes up for a lot of other things. It can be a pressure to publish for staff members, particularly. It can be thinking one might get away with it, or that you're entitled, in a way. It's just a paper, you know. It can be academic pride, the want for success. It can be a lot of things. And sometimes, of course, you know, forgetting to put in a citation or something seems very irrelevant, but it is really important. And of course, you know, not according to style and everything, that you put the comma in the right place and things, that's not the important thing. But learning a style and adhering to it makes it easier for yourself and, of course, for the reader to understand what kind of sources you're using. I really don't want you to fail this, so this is why I'm spending so much time talking about it. And I've worked here for quite a few years now, and I've seen so many student papers, countless, and some get it right away because they just understand the system, and others struggle, and still, you know, during the master's program they haven't got it right, and that, you know, makes it more difficult for you, obviously. Yeah, just ignore it. Someone is calling me. academic honesty. There are three principles. And they may seem very easy and very commonplace in a way. But they do form the structure of what academic writing is all about. So if you get this, you have good chances of succeeding. Yeah? The first one. When you say you did the work yourself, you actually did it. And that means finding someone else to write for you, or, you know, copy-pasting, things like that. Just unacceptable. Do the work yourself. Writing is learning. It really is. And it took me a long time to figure this out, really. I did my bachelor's years and years ago, and then I was really proud at it, I was really proud that I got a good grade. I got to teach younger students involved in my program because I wrote about something that the teachers really weren't that, you know, they didn't know too much about at the time. And I was really pleased with myself. And then when I did my master's years afterwards, I went back and looked at the bachelor's and I was so embarrassed. I cringed, you know, because it was completely flawed. I hadn't, you know, plagiarized or anything like that. So it wasn't, and I certainly hadn't cheated. So it wasn't like that at all. But it was still, you know, completely flawed. And while you're writing, you will learn something. And then you will go back and see, oh, God, I can't believe I did that, you know. So writing is learning. So you really need to do the work yourself. Otherwise, your years here and all the money you've spent studying will be wasted. So do the work yourself. Number two is when you rely on someone else's work, you cite it. And this, I once had a few years back, I had a master student in my office. And she was complaining about having to cite. Well, not having to cite, because she understood that, but she was... She didn't understand why she had to get other people's ideas into her work. What's exciting about that? She says. Why do I want to use other people's ideas in my text? You'll never have any original work because all I have to do is cite someone else, she said. And I thought, you know, in a way, I understand that. You know, in a way, I understand why you want to write something on your own. But the thing is, it doesn't really work like that. Because there's always something existing about a subject. At least on this level. I mean, there are doctorates and everything that are doing like groundbreaking work, but generally, there already exists something. I think now they said every 3 days we produce as much information as they did from, you know, the beginning of written words until 1750, I think, or about there. Every 3 days. So there is just an enormous amount of information out there. So there is probably something already written on your subject. And your job is to make meaningful connections between other people's ideas and your own. That is new knowledge. That is what this is all about. So we're not just making you do this just of a technicality. Your job is to make the meaningful connections. Always remember that. And, of course, it provides credibility for your own work. It gives credit to the original author. It provides evidence and support for your arguments. All that is important. But remember, meaningful connections. That's your job. Above everything else. And of course, you know, choose a citation style and then stick to it. Yeah. How many of you are using LaTeX? Yeah, about half. Are you using BibTeX? Little program, yeah. You really should, if you're using LaTeX. Then use BibTeX. Because most of you will use the Vancouver style, and it's a numbered style. And you get confused in a two-page paper. I've already seen it. So get used to using BibTeX right away. How many are you using Word or Pages? Yeah. Are you using EndNote? No? It's a good idea. We have licenses for all of you for EndNote, and they work. EndNote works with, well, at least words and a word and pages. Probably several others too. Yeah. And you can sign up for courses if you like. Yep. Do it now, because you'll have like thousands of references by the time you're finished here. And the sooner you get it into a library, the better. Yeah. Okay. Number three, present research materials fairly and truthfully. A few years back, there was a doctor who worked in Oslo. I think he worked with cancer patients and everything. And he was a really renowned researcher as well. And he did a huge study. I can't remember what it was about. And it was published in The Lancet. It was really prestigious. One of the world's most famous medical journals. Peer-reviewed, everything. And then they discovered that all his data was fabricated. Yeah, and people used his research in treating patients. And it was all made up. That is not presenting research data fairly and truthfully. And of course, that's, you know, it has had great repercussions, and the man's, of course, reputation was completely destroyed. And he left his job and everything, of course. Or he was fired, obviously. But in your field, it may not come to, you know, life and health of people. But it's still important that you present your data truthfully and fairly. And that means you don't fabricate data. You don't say that a study showed this and that if it didn't. And you don't make the assumption that your study will support an idea if you don't have the data to support it. Yeah? This is really important. I feel like I'm doing like the really harsh lecture, like a, you know, priest from 2,000 years ago. But but you get the idea, right? Yeah, they seem very easy and commonplace. But you have to remember these three. If you remember nothing else than these three from this lesson, I'll be a happy woman, okay? Yeah, these three. Really important. Yeah, the citation styles. They're all explained in something called VIKO. V-I-K-O. Which you can find, just search for it, Google it. And they have an English version as well. And they describe the different citation styles. I think the interaction design, students, where are you? Yeah, quite a few of you. You're going to use Harvard, as far as I know, the Harvard style. That's an author date style. So when you do in-text references, you use the author's surname and the year. And if you have a direct quotation, you know, cut and paste from something, you include the page number. The rest of you are probably going to use the Vancouver style, and that's a numbered style. So the first time you enter a source in your text, that will have number one. And the next one will have number two, etc. For you who are using the Vancouver style, it is a very good idea to use a reference manager like EndNote or BibTeX. And that is why, when you're writing, I don't know about you, but I can never write anything linear. You know, I can't just start and then write it through and not make corrections. I always have to go back and make corrections. And then when you've written 1.5 pages and then you find out, no, I need to include something more, then if you do this manually, then you have to, you know, change the numbers of all the things that comes after. And I've seen that every year. I've seen someone who misses that, you know, and I don't think it's intentional, but then suddenly the bibliography doesn't match the in-text citations. Yeah, and this is just two pages. Imagine what it's going to be like in your master thesis. Yeah. So use a ref manager. It just makes your life easier, because that will obviously do it automatically. In Vancouver, they will have the numbered style in the bibliography as well. So then, you know, it doesn't matter what the surname of the author is, because it will be in the order that you put it into the text. But in the Harvard style, it will be alphabetically ordered, no matter when you put it in the text. Yeah, those are the like main differences between those two styles. I just included one example just so you could have a look at it. But you should refer you to Vico, because then the entire style is explained. If you're using EndNote, then the Vancouver style that's already included in the program will do the work for you. If you're using EndNote and Harvard, that combination, you need to just download a little output style filter. That's also in Vico, just to make the style fit. Yeah. Any questions about this? No? Okay. Now, for the essay number two, you probably won't have this problem with copyrighted material, because it's only two pages and you don't want to spend one page in including a graph that, you know, you don't. But it is very important that you pay some attention to this, because Norwegian copyright law is not necessarily entirely the same as from your respective countries. The Norwegian copyright law is very much like the American copyright law, as opposed to the French droit d'auteur. That's different. It deals with the same problems, but they have different aspect on that. But ours is very much alike the American equivalent. Finding an image on the internet does not mean that you have the right to reproduce it. Someone is owning that. Yeah. The same goes for, I've seen so many students, they go into the copy room and then they just scan a page from the textbook and then paste it into their papers. And even with a citation, you cannot do that. Because an image, a graph, a table, you know, things like that, they are a copyrighted work in itself, as opposed to a book where you can, you know, you can cite, but you can't just take, copy paste the entire book. And you understand that. But taking an image is like taking the entire book, because the image is a work in itself. Kind of difficult to explain in English, I find myself thinking now, but do you understand this? Yeah. Students are not the only ones who do this, you know, who take things that doesn't belong to them. Teachers do it too, and they put it into their PowerPoints. And that's not a problem. It's not a problem when you have it in a PowerPoint. But the moment I upload that PowerPoint to Blackboard, then I have a problem. You see? It's all about the publication. If you took an image from the internet and then just printed it out and gave it to your teacher, it wouldn't be a problem, because it isn't published. But the moment you upload it into Blackboard, even though that is protected by a password, it counts as publishing. And then you have the problem. Yeah. So, yeah, it's important to think about these things. If you want to use something you found in a textbook and you want to scan it and put it into your paper, you need proper authorization from the publisher or the author. Usually you can contact some sort of PR office in the publishing company. But is it worth it? Is what you should be thinking. Yeah. If you want to use images, that can be covered by a stock photo service. Then we have access. In Gjøvik campus, we have access to something called Colorbox. And you can read more about it on the internet, I think. There's more information about how you get access to the pictures. And you can get 30 pictures a month for download. And they can be used without restriction. You only have to say colorbox.com or something, illustration under. And then you're safe because we've already purchased access to those pictures. Yeah. Or you can look for Creative Commons licenses, obviously. So things that, you know, illustrations from Wikipedia and things are usually released with a, I think they called it Wikimedia, something that it's produced with a Creative Commons license. Doesn't necessarily mean you should use it, but, you know. Yeah. When I say this to students, they usually think it is sort of strict, that they cannot use whatever they like in their papers. But yeah, you should consider this because it is considered unacademic. So you can, well, actually the school can get in trouble with it. I've heard of people, you know, using poems, etc., in their texts. And a poem is just like a picture. It is a work in itself. And in one university in the West Coast, they actually got fined for breaking the copyright law. Yeah, because one of their students said, and the students had to pay. But yeah, so just don't do it. It's easier. Yeah. I don't have anything more for you today. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer, at least. 2-page essay? That's doable, right? In 2 weeks? I should hope so, anyway. Yeah? Just upload it into Blackboard. I've put the slides for today into Blackboard already, and I'll put the links to the video I made in there. And there's a recording as well of this lecture. Did you find it useful at all? Some of it? Yeah? Good. And, you know, I'll be happy to take any questions later if you have any. But if you don't have any more right now, then I'll release you and wish you a good day.